Welcome to Broken Law, the podcast about the law, whose interests it serves, and whose it does not. Brought to you by the American Constitution Society, 501c3, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. I'm Lindsay Langholz, Senior Director for Policy and Program at ACS. It has been months of conversation about the 14th Amendment and how to deal with folks who engaged in insurrection appearing or not appearing on the ballot. And we are so excited today to dig in on one case in particular that has come up out of Colorado, which features a conversation about Donald Trump, but has much broader applications as well. So looking forward to digging in with two very special guests. One is a return all-star of Broken Law, Donald Sherman, who serves as Executive Vice President and Chief Counsel at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, also known as CREW. He has served in various oversight, ethics, and policy roles in the executive branch and Congress, and we are so delighted to have him back. And joining him today is Nikhil Suss. He is the Director of Strategic Litigation at CREW, where he specializes in litigation focused on government accountability, transparency, and ethics. During his time at CREW, he has achieved notable court victories, including the removal of a Mexico County commissioner for his participation in the January 6th insurrection, a case we will certainly touch on in this conversation. Donald and Nick, welcome to Broken Law. We are so excited to get to talk about what's been going on in your case. What are the details? What should we know? And kind of just break down what can maybe seem complicated to other folks. And so I want to dive right in and do a little bit of table setting. When we are talking about this case in particular, we're talking about the 14th Amendment, but a specific part of the 14th Amendment. So could you explain what the actual piece of law is at issue, and also what context it was ratified in?
So Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was adopted after the Civil War, primarily to disqualify former Confederates and specifically former Confederate leaders from holding federal or state office after the Civil War, the theory being that they had taken an oath to support the Constitution in some federal or state position and then had violated that oath by engaging in an insurrection or rebellion against the Constitution. The terms of Section 3 are not, however, limited to the Civil War. Both the drafting history and the text of Section 3 make clear that the provision of the 14th Amendment applies not just to the Civil War, but also future insurrections or rebellions. And so while the provision has largely laid dormant since Reconstruction, when it was enforced in state courts and in some federal courts, the events of January 6, 2021 have brought the provision back into relevance. And that is where we are today.
I'm curious how often this has been used. You mentioned the Civil War history. How often was it used then? And then how do we bring it forward to the current moment?
So it was used frequently in the Reconstruction period, the period immediately after the Civil War. It was enforced at the state level in a variety of ways through state courts. It was enforced by the military in states that were under military Reconstruction, that were under occupation by the federal government. In the period immediately after the war, before those states had been readmitted into the Union and formed functional state governments. It was also incorporated into the post-Confederate states' constitutions. And so those state constitutions incorporated the requirements of the 14th Amendment, including Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, into their own laws through that manner. It was understood widely in this period that former Confederates who had held office before the Civil War and then engaged in the Confederate Rebellion were disqualified even without a court ruling. The Congress was inundated with individual amnesty requests from former Confederates who asked that their disability be lifted pursuant to the terms of Section 3, which provides that while an individual who is subject to disqualification is barred from office, that disqualification may be lifted by a two-thirds vote of each House of Congress. And so what you saw in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War was a number of ex-Confederates petitioning Congress for this amnesty. And Congress was so overwhelmed with these individual requests that they eventually passed a blanket amnesty legislation less than 4 years after the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868. And that largely removed the disability from all former Confederates, except for those at the very the sort of the leadership class, including Jefferson Davis and other individuals who held very high government positions prior to the war. And the thinking there was that while it was okay to lift the disability for sort of low-level officials, the Reconstruction Congress did not want to lift the disability for the leaders of the Confederacy. And so there was really just a brief period of enforcement, that four-year period, where Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was actively enforced. But after the Amnesty Act was passed in 1872, it largely laid dormant until the events of January 6th.
Interesting. So fast forward to January 6th, and I know this is a question that came up at trial, so I'm going to ask a deeper question later. But there was an insurrection on January 6th, and many, many people attended, so not just Donald Trump swept up in this particular legal reasoning. What was the first case that y'all brought after the events of January 6th to kind of resurrect this usage of Section 3?
So I think in the immediate aftermath of January 6th, you saw a couple of people. I recall we wrote something about this. Sherrilyn Ifill tweeted some things about it. But you saw, a few people talking about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and that it might apply to the events of January 6th. And, as we saw in the bipartisan votes in the House and the Senate to impeach Donald Trump, and then the bipartisan votes in following his impeachment trial, though ultimately short of the two-thirds majority to convict him, there was a consistent bipartisan view in both chambers of Congress that January 6th was an insurrection and that Donald Trump incited it. The real question of, what do these things mean and how can they be operationalized began for us in earnest in the fall of 2021, when we started thinking really closely about what it might look like to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. We brought a case shortly thereafter in March of 2022 against Coy Griffin, who was an Otero County commissioner who, in addition to holding his government office, which required him to take an oath to support the U.S. Constitution, he traveled from New Mexico to Washington, D.C. in the aftermath of the election for the January 6th certification to attend Donald Trump's wild rally. And in the course of doing so, he repeatedly helped to mobilize and recruit people to come to D.C. and to be violent on January 6th. And then on January 6th, he, among other things, grabbed a bullhorn and assumed a leadership role in the crowd and really helped mobilize folks there, including chanting "Heave Ho" as the insurrectionists used police shields to try to breach the Capitol. If you've watched any video from January 6th, you've seen a video of DC Metro Police Officer Danny Hodges being crushed in that tunnel as the crowd chants "Heave Ho." And so, we spent a lot of time looking at who this provision could apply to, what office holders who took an oath to support the Constitution participated in the January 6th insurrection. Coy Griffin was at the top of that list because of his conduct, because he did us the favor of documenting so much of his conduct, both before, during, and we would soon discover after January 6th, and because New Mexico state law afforded residents of the state an opportunity to enforce a disqualification in state court under the state quo warranto statute. And so those factors, among others, led us to bringing a case in New Mexico on behalf of three New Mexico residents to remove Coy Griffin from his office in Otero County, New Mexico. We brought that case in Santa Fe in March, and the quo warranto statute in New Mexico has expedited proceedings. And so, normal trial practice, to the extent that I know anything about it, tends to take a while. But this got us to trial in 5 months, which is pretty quick, though there were lots of events that sort of took place in trial practice and federal court issues that Nick really took the lead on navigating to make sure that, we actually were able to file our case in state court and then get to put on that trial in state court in New Mexico in August of last year.
I'm going to turn to you, Nick, to give us the results of what the court found and what kind of precedent it laid for the future cases.
Sure. So the trial court in the Coy Griffin case held that Mr. Griffin did engage in the January 6th insurrection, that the events of January 6th and the preceding mobilization and incitement were an insurrection against the Constitution of the United States, and that Mr. Griffin breached his oath to the Constitution by engaging in that insurrection. A couple of notable things about that ruling are that Mr. Griffin was not personally violent. He was within the mob, within the restricted perimeter of the Capitol, but did not go inside of the Capitol building. And he did not attack police officers or any other individuals protecting the Capitol building. But the court nonetheless recognized that through his words and conduct that he had promoted the violence by those folks that were around him in the mob that day, and that merely by being within the restricted perimeter where police had deployed tear gas and pepper spray and tried to make the thousands of individuals that had walked over to the Capitol building from President Trump's rally to make them leave, the fact that he stayed there regardless of those efforts contributed to law enforcement being overwhelmed that day and contributed to the sort of temporary success of the insurrectionists in delaying the electoral vote count. The court also confirmed that state courts can and have enforced Section 3 of the 14th Amendment even without an act of Congress to sort of effectuate or sort of grant permission for that enforcement. That is an argument that we have heard in the case involving President Trump. And in other contexts, the court rejected the argument that there is any federal legislation necessary to effectuate this part of the Constitution. And the court also rejected Mr. Griffin's arguments that his conduct that day was protected by the First Amendment, and confirmed, in line with the rulings of scores of D.C. District Court judges that have heard the January 6th criminal cases, that the efforts on January 6th to oppose the electoral vote count were not protected First Amendment activity. It was a concerted effort to stop a constitutional process, and that activity is not protected by the First Amendment.
And so bring us forward to the case that we just recently had a decision out of District Court out in Colorado. What is the case that you brought and what claims were you making? Help us connect the two, the Griffin case with the Trump case.
So in terms of the procedural mechanism, Colorado law allows voters, what the law calls electors or eligible electors, to file lawsuits to challenge the constitutional eligibility of a presidential primary candidate. Not every state has a law like that. And the fact that Colorado has that law and provides a cause of action, a private right of action to voters, is significant in and of itself. And so what this lawsuit was is a suit brought under that law, under that state law, that seeks to bar the Secretary of State from placing Donald Trump on the presidential primary ballot on the grounds that he is not qualified to take the office. And here it's important to emphasize that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is a qualification for office. It is akin to the qualification that the president be at least 35 years old, that he be a natural born citizen, not having served two prior terms as president, and having resided in the United States for at least 14 years. The only difference is that this particular qualification has never been questioned with respect to a presidential candidate before. And that is, of course, a result of Donald Trump's unprecedented actions on and around January 6th. But the fact remains that this is yet another qualification for the office. And the procedural mechanism that we've used to get into court is the same type of mechanism you would choose to challenge a president who was not a natural born citizen or didn't meet the age requirement or didn't meet some other qualification in the Constitution. So the proceeding is highly expedited. Colorado law requires that these types of election challenges be heard promptly in advance of ballot certification. And the idea here is to minimize any disruption on the electoral process and to resolve these sorts of questions in advance of the election and to have all appeals resolved in advance of the election. And so we are prospectively asking the secretary not to list Donald Trump on the ballot based on his constitutional ineligibility to serve as president. We proceeded to a week-long bench trial after the judge in the case denied several motions to dismiss by the former president. At that trial, both sides had full and fair opportunity to present witness testimony. both sides called witnesses to the events of January 6th, and that both sides presented witnesses with respect to Donald Trump's words and actions that day and in the events leading up to it. The court issued a ruling recently, as you know, that ruled in our favor and petitioner's favor on every legal and factual question in the case. The court held that January 6, 2021, and the surrounding events were an insurrection against the Constitution under the 14th Amendment. The court held that Donald Trump engaged in that insurrection and that his speech was not protected by the First Amendment, as he had asserted. In addition, the court rejected each one of former President Trump's sort of procedural and justiciability defenses, including his political question argument, his argument that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment requires an act of Congress, and other non-merits questions. She resolved those questions ahead of trial. The court also admitted specific findings from the January 6th Select Committee's report, and the court rejected arguments by the former president that that report was inadmissible under the rules of evidence. And based on that, the court found that, again, that Donald Trump engaged in an insurrection on January 6th, on and around January 6th. Now, the kicker is that at the end of the decision, in the last few pages of a 100-plus page decision, the court held that despite the fact that Donald Trump engaged in an insurrection, he can still be placed on the ballot because in the court's view, it was unclear whether Section 3 of the 14th Amendment applies to the presidency and former presidents, and specifically one whose only prior oath was as the president of the United States. The judge held, among other things, that it's not clear that the president's oath, in which the president takes an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, qualifies as an oath to support the Constitution. And the court also pointed to language in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment that suggested to her that the president might not be an officer of the United States and that the president of the United States might not hold an office under the United States. Both parties have appealed the ruling. Both Trump and the petitioners have appealed the ruling. We appealed one issue, the narrow issue of whether Section 3 of the 14th Amendment applies to the president and the presidency. Former President Trump appealed on nearly a dozen issues, and we are on track to have that case heard in the Colorado Supreme Court.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation.
I want to make sure that we don't blow past the first pieces and focus on the narrow ruling, which I do want to ask about. But this is the first time that a president has ever been found by a court to have engaged in an insurrection. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that's huge. I want to make sure that we're underlining that. That is a phenomenal result to
underline away.
Yeah, I mean, it is such an undertaking to have a court see the evidence, come to the what I think a lot of us feel is obvious conclusion, but nonetheless, the power of a court doing so. I want to make sure we take a pause and really highlight that before digging in on the narrow piece of the ruling. So, kudos to your team.
Yeah, I mean, there's only been two cases under Section 3 that have gone to trial, the one that we brought in New Mexico and the one that we had this year with candidate Trump. I'm sorry, actually three. There was a evidentiary hearing last fall with Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, there have only been two cases where a court has determined that January 6th was an insurrection consistent with Section 3. And as you said, this is the first case, despite the overwhelming amount of public evidence and public discourse that Donald Trump engaged in an insurrection and that January 6th obviously was one. This is the first court decision where a judge has weighed evidence, heard testimony. I believe we had seven witnesses present on our side, and the Trump team put on about the same number. So a five-day trial, multiple witnesses, thousands of pages of evidence, and the court issued a pretty detailed factual finding and a series of factual findings confirming that Donald Trump engaged in insurrection consistent with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
It's remarkable that we are several years past. It feels like we're living so much under the shadow of January 6th and going into a new election cycle. I think it's important for these types of decisions to be before the voters as we go forward and deal with the places where insurrections are on the ballot and to the extent that that record can be put in front of them. I do want to ask about the officer question, just because that is the hook of the appeal. And I'm curious, to a layperson, it's the office of the presidency. It feels like it's a pretty straightforward question. And so I wanted to ask specifically, you know, what is there, I guess, on both sides of just this question? It's obviously not one that any court has ever had to deal with before in this context. And I'm curious what the arguments are, both on both sides, but it feels like an obvious question to me. And so I don't mean to tip the hand too much, but I'd be curious to hear both sides.
I will start with where you are, which is that I agree with you. I think that it is a fairly obvious question. You know, I think Judge Wallace deserves a lot of credit for her really thoughtful decision. This is obviously an area where we disagree with her findings, but we have an opportunity to appeal that decision before the Colorado Supreme Court. We believe that the text is clear in Section 3 and that the President of the United States is included in civil and military officers under the United States and that the President is an officer of the United States. But also, we believe that the history of the drafting of Section 3 and the intent of the drafters is all consistent with a reading that we believe is in the text that the president and the presidency are included within the language of Section 3. And, you know, as you said, you know, the Constitution is meant to be understood, meant to be interpreted as, you know, regular folks understand it. And I think, this is in our view, a simple analysis, but they're certainly, as lawyers can do, we can make complex arguments in support. And former President Trump has made complex arguments in arguing that the president is excluded, not least of which, as Nick mentioned, you know, the oath of office for the president says to preserve, protect, and defend, but does not include the explicit word support. And, you know, our view is that, you know, support is a description, not it is not sort of magic words, and that, you know, the oath that the president gives, the oath of office, funnily enough, as it's called, is an oath to support the Constitution. But former president makes a number of other legal arguments that Section 3 was not meant to include the president or the presidency. And, you know, I think Nick can tell you a little bit more about why those are wrong. But, you know, one thing that I thought, you know, I think there were a couple of interesting things about how Judge Wallace handled the issue. One, she pointed to the fact that, well, it's possible that the presidency was included by virtue of the drafters of Section 3 explicitly mentioning presidential electors. And it would seem weird that the drafters of Section 3 would have been concerned enough about an insurrectionist president that they would have mentioned electors, but not have considered the president to be included in their explicit words. But also, as Nick alluded to at the beginning, you know, she essentially said that, you know, there are strong arguments on both sides, but where there are strong arguments on both sides, she thought that it made sense to give deference to the former president. And, you know, it would seem somewhat strange, and I think others have noted this, that in that sort of balancing test, that deference is given to the person that she determined was an insurrectionist. But again, we disagree. And so we have an opportunity to make our arguments before the Colorado Supreme Court on the merits, and we are prepared to do so. Nick, I don't know if there's more you want to add about the details.
Yeah, I mean, I would just underscore the point that, you know, this is not an issue where we should leave our common sense at the door. Office means office. The Constitution refers to the presidency as an office 26 times. And any reading that suggests that the presidency is not an office, or it's under something, but it's not the United States. Nobody knows what it's under. Nobody knows what it's of. But he's an officer and it's an office. And yet we don't know the answers to these questions. I think that does a lot of the work in getting you to the answer, the right answer on this particular issue. And, you know, that's not to say that that is our only sort of response to these points. There is overwhelming evidence that at the time the 14th Amendment was ratified, everyone thought the president was a officer. And even Trump has admitted in his briefing that the president is an officer, and specifically that he's the chief executive officer of the United States. So, and I also want to stress, like, if this reading is accepted, it wouldn't have its repercussions wouldn't be limited to the 14th Amendment. There are several provisions of the Constitution that refer to or that impose restrictions tied to any person holding an office under the United States. And so if the president's view were accepted, the president could accept emoluments from foreign governments. The president could be a senator or a member of Congress and the president at the same time, because the incompatibility clause wouldn't apply to the president. Somebody who is convicted in an impeachment and removed from office could still be the president, because the impeachment disqualification clause only applies to any office under the United States. And the list goes on, but the absurdities that would follow from this conclusion cannot be underestimated. And so that is another significant point that must be sort of understood within the context of this argument, that it's not sort of just limited to this particular issue. But yeah, I will end where I started and just say that we should, you know, focus on common sense here and not lose sight of that when we consider these arguments.
I'm also struck by your comments earlier, Nick, about the way that the Reconstruction Congress was approaching these requests to waive the disqualification, and that they still maintained the disqualification for those who were more in charge and more and responsible for the situation. And so, to me, as just an outside person who hasn't been in the weeds as much as you both have, it feels like a reverse of that instinct to be like, the president is above this. The president is above this particular rule. Everybody else maybe is considered, but this is the one exception. It feels like a true inversion of that instinct.
That is exactly right. You know, one of the points that we had made in our briefing is that during the amnesty debates over this legislation to sort of grant wholesale amnesty to large swaths of the ex-Confederates, they specifically discussed whether they should apply it to Jefferson Davis. And everybody said, no, we do not want to extend this to Jefferson Davis because he is the type of person that we really want to keep disqualified. And we do not want to lift this disability from, because they recognize the dangers of somebody who held that level of influence with a insurrectionary movement, and the dangers of allowing somebody who had, you know, clearly violated their oath of the Constitution to hold office again. And so we think that is, you know, compelling evidence that the same Congress that passed Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and the amnesty, subsequent amnesty legislation, fully intended to target the leaders and did not budge from that conclusion, even when there was significant political pressure to grant amnesty to large swaths of the ex-Confederacy.
I want to ask a broader question of, as folks are paying attention, and we will, of course, have things in the notes for folks to learn more there, but also as they pay attention to what the Colorado State Supreme Court eventually decides, what is your hope for folks taking away from this particular case as it progresses? I know that when the Cui Griffin case first came out, there was a lot of skepticism within the election law space that has really faded over time as y'all have pursued this particular line of case work. We're seeing conservatives, liberals, folks across all parts of the political spectrum come out in support of this reading of Section 3. And so I'm curious, as folks are listening who are maybe not aware of kind of all of the background, what do you hope they take away from this case, but also the work that you're doing in this space?
My takeaway from this is that the Constitution has to abide. And it has to abide when the questions are easy, but it was built for the questions that are hard. And I understand, certainly we understand, that there is a reticence, or, you know, there may be some anxiety about folks enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment against Donald Trump. But we know that Donald Trump engaged in an insurrection. We know that January 6th was an insurrection, right? There were bipartisan votes in the House and the Senate shortly after January 6th. And now there's a judge that has weighed evidence and said so. The disqualification clause, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, was built for this moment, for the unfortunate times that we find ourselves in. The real question is, are we? Do we have the will? Do courts have the will to enforce this provision of the Constitution that was specifically designed as a safety mechanism to prevent insurrectionists from holding office again in a moment where maybe it is difficult for one reason or another? Again, we have courts and a constitution not for when things are easy, but for when they are hard. And if we don't, if the Constitution isn't enforced in this moment, when can you imagine that it would be? If not now, then when? And so, you know, if I want folks to take anything away from it, it's that. But also that, you know, there are a ton of people from, you know, people with a great deal of power, like Mike Pence, to folks who don't have much power at all, like Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman, like the six brave plaintiffs in our case in Colorado, that have chosen to stand up to Donald Trump's attempt to erode the Constitution, specifically, you know, his oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution in various moments. This is one of them. We are grateful to our plaintiffs and hopeful that, you know, their rights will be vindicated in this case and that the Constitution will be vindicated in this case. But yeah, if I had any takeaways, it was that. I'm sure Nick has others.
Yeah, I mean, I think one fundamental takeaway is that it is the court's job to interpret the Constitution. That is an argument that seems uncontroversial, but you'd be surprised how much time and energy we have expended on litigating that issue. The notion that state courts cannot enforce the Constitution of the United States because Congress hasn't given them permission to do so, and it's not explicitly spelled out in the Constitution, is sort of repugnant to the constitutional order, repugnant to federalism and how our system of government works, and really would be a low watermark for constitutional supremacy in this country. The idea that, you know, certain provisions of the Constitution have to be unlocked by the Congress, it makes no sense and is contrary to decades or centuries rather of Supreme Court precedent. And we've strenuously made that argument. That was one of the arguments that Judge Wallace accepted. But just the notion that this has become such an issue of who decides what the Constitution means is somewhat frustrating for us because, you know, we've spent a lot of time in the issue and we're sort of deep in the weeds on it. But like fundamentally, the courts say what the Constitution means, and this case is no different. As long as the state law procedures provide a cause of action for this type of question to be litigated, it's not an option. You know, we don't have an option about whether we should interpret the Constitution. It is an imperative. It is a duty. And so there are obviously questions on the merits relating to Trump and his eligibility to hold office and the reasons why, you know, it is important to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment against somebody who has continuously showed their disregard for the Constitution. But I think there are a lot of fundamental questions about how our Constitution is enforced, who can enforce it, and at what stage it can be enforced, that are very weighty and consequential that will potentially have reverberations outside of this case, but that are significant in how our country governs itself going forward. And we are hopeful that the courts will resolve those issues correctly, as well as the merits of former President Trump's disqualification.
For folks who want to learn more, where can they turn? What should they pick up to do a deeper dive on this particular issue?
Well, certainly our website, www.citizensforethics.org. Our X or Twitter is at CrewCrew. Yeah, I think those are probably the best places to track what's happening in the case. You know, the docket is up on the Colorado Supreme Court webpage, which I don't know the URL off the top of my head.
We won't hold you to it.
Yeah, since we get the emails. But yeah, you know, I think those are probably the three places that I would, you know, I would go to track information about this case.
Well, Donald, Nick, thank you so much for joining. Thank you for the work that you're doing. We're so appreciative for your time. I know it's busy right now, and I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure that folks listening in have too. So appreciate you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, also, we hire interns and fellows.
There you go. Love it. Take that next step.
Thank you.
Donald and Nick, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you to our listeners for finding Broken Law. Please be sure to follow and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. If you enjoy hearing from Donald in particular, I encourage you to go back and listen to episode 105. He always brings incredible insight, and that is his most recent appearance on Broken Law. If you're enjoying the show, help us bring it to more listeners by giving us a 5-star review and recommending it to a friend. And if you have ideas for future episodes, please let us know. I love hearing about them. You can email us at podcast@acflaw.org or find us on social media at @acslaw. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interest it really serves and whose it does not.